Welcome to Cabronas y Chingonas, a podcast where we talk about queer and Latinx topics such as...
Taylor Swift is fucking gay.
Okay. Elaborate.
I mean, she recently released a song called You Need to Calm Down, and she's basically, like, yelling gay rights, and she's having a music video come out that should have, like, even Billy Porter in it, which I stan Billy Porter, so whatever she's doing, that's correct. And I'm with it. And she also has an equality act that she had like 100,000 people sign to send to the White House, even though that's literally going to do probably nothing. But her impact on like her little white girls is really taking its toll. So I really hope she does something as an supposed ally. But I just think she's gay. Shout out Gaylor Swift.
I hope that she's really doing something because she sure did like co-opt a whole lot of, words that and phrases that like queer black people like to use and this new little song of hers, and I was like, what's she doing here? But I guess let's see what happens with this video.
I mean, she even sang at Stonewall, which if she's not actually gay, I need her to sit down, but this is me still assuming that she is queer. She's part of the family. If she's not, then she can sit the fuck down. Please stop taking up space. Anyways. Was poppin', chingona, was good. I'm alive.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's Texas. I survived something like 25 years of it. It's just always going to be chaotic.
Yeah, every Sunday it's been like tornado with 70 mile per hour winds. And I'm like, fuck. But it's never been that bad where I lost electricity for like 48 plus hours. But it's all Gucci. How was it over there? How you doing? You said you... had something to say.
I probably did. I don't know. I forgot what it was.
Yeah. We kind of got into like this like huge like Taylor Swift discussion.
I guess. Yeah. I just was confused about it all. But anyways, yeah, I don't want to waste that much time talking about Taylor Swift. Is that mean of me?
No, I mean,
maybe once her like little music video comes out, then maybe we'll.
I mean, you really don't like her,
and
I
never said that.
Well, how do you feel about her? How do you feel about her?
I don't want to talk about her.
Okay.
I don't dislike her, but I also don't want to like waste time talking about her right now.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, what did you want to talk about today then?
I want to talk about Spike Lee a little bit.
Okay. So. Recently saw something from him, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've been watching. I mean, obviously, I'm covering it for the show today. But also, I got this like new TV because I've been wild stressed lately. So I decided to treat myself, and I've been watching this Spike Lee thing on the Netflix, which has been kind of interesting. I don't know. I guess we haven't really ever talked about Spike Lee. I think maybe I've mentioned Do the Right Thing once or twice, which is like a movie that I really, really like, I don't know, I think about a lot because especially as a person that consumes and talks about media a lot, because that's a movie that like, that really kind of blew my mind because you think it's about one thing and on the surface it's about one thing. And then at the end of it, you're just like he throws it in your face. Like, what are you questioning? Like, why are you questioning, you know, why the main character broke the glass on this pizza shop instead of like why this man is dead? So I don't know. It makes me think a lot. And
no, yeah, I've like, because maybe we do think, well, I think several things about Spike Lee and they're not really that favorable, and I don't have the highest opinion of him. I think as a filmmaker he's genius, but
I think some of the things fair. He says problematic things.
Yeah, he's super problematic. That's my problem with him. And then, like, his filmmaking, we can criticize, but it's not like I'd find a lot of things wrong, you know? Not with his actual, like, filmmaking ability, nor the way he tells stories. Like, I think those are very well done, and I think he's a great writer. He always gets his point across. Whether or not I like what his point is what... what kind of bothers me about him is, like, his whole point is very, like, 14-year-old, I just got woke boy, you know? And it's, like, kind of annoying, and I wish he'd do more work. I wish that Ava was applauded in the same way that Spike Lee is, and if she is, I hope she's applauded more in so many ways, because I feel like in a lot of ways they give Spike Lee a lot more credit than I think he deserves for what his morals are versus his, just, you know, his filmmaking ability, which is, are two separate things.
Yeah. I mean, the most recent thing that has kind of come out that put him back in the spotlight, other than She's Gotta Have It, the Netflix original show, which isn't getting that much hype, to be honest. So I would say, like, what's really put him in the media recently was Black Klansman. And that was both negative and positive. It, obviously, it was, like, nominated at the Oscars, and he won an award. And even, like, I guess in the context of that night, which is, like, Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody winning awards that they didn't deserve, it was almost like, wow, like, I'm okay with this right now because, you know, so many people that don't deserve these awards are getting it. And maybe Black Klansman wasn't, like, the most, it definitely didn't come out at the right time, and maybe had some messages that weren't so great, but God, at least it wasn't Green Book, I don't know. And then I also, a lot of people think that, like, hey, she should have won an Oscar for Do the Right Thing, and he didn't, so.
I mean, what happens with the Oscars is that, like, people that deserve their Oscar, they get it for something that they don't really deserve it for later on. You know, they did the same thing, to Denzel. Leo deserved it a long time ago. Denzel Washington deserved it a long time ago. Like, they do this to people that are really, really popular in real life, that people love in real life. They're like, you know what? Fuck you. You have everything. We're not going to give you an Oscar till we're going to make you wait. And that's what they did to Spike Lee. Like, he deserved it for Do the Right Thing, not so much for Black Klansman.
Right, I agree.
You're like, he deserved it 20 years ago, whenever that movie came out. That's when, that's his masterpiece, and to this day that stands. Black Klansman doesn't even compare.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot more to say about Spike Lee, but we can talk about it some more once I cover my subject. We should talk a little bit about Barry Jenkins, who's another director that we're going to be covering today.
Barry Jenkins is amazing, and in a lot of ways, I feel like his artistry is pulling from something that is the complete opposite of Spike Lee, and that Spike Lee is in your face. His directional style, his story style is in your face. It's loud. It's obnoxious. It's going, here I am. Here's the message. I'm going to literally shove it in your face for an hour, 2 hours. Whereas Barry Jenkins is taking something different. He's taking a, like, you know, he said he was inspired by Wong Kar-wai from a, he's an amazing director. I haven't seen a shit. But anyways, it's more quiet. It's more subtle. It makes you actually think. There's an open-endedness to both If Beale Street Could Talk and Moonlight. They're both beautiful films, and they're both not shoving it in your face. They're, instead of showing you this, the, you know, there's different ways to be black, and there's different ways to express sensitivity, thoughtfulness. Just, there's so many layers to Barry Jenkins that he's, you have to actually think about, you have to actually watch and think and pull those layers apart as you watch both films. And whereas it's completely different from Spike Lee and his directional style. So I personally prefer Barry Jenkins, and I think what he does with his art is beautiful. And I think he's elevating all art right now. And I think he's been doing that. And it's beautiful. I love Barry Jenkins.
Yeah, Barry Jenkins is dope. How long has he been around? I don't know a whole lot about Barry Jenkins. Has he been around in the game as long as Spike Lee has?
Oh, definitely not. Barry Jenkins is way younger. Barry Jenkins, I think he started off with, like, this indie film that got, like, a lot of press, maybe 2009, 2008. He went to Paris. They had already given greenlit, If Beale Street Could Talk and Moonlight. He wrote both of them while he was in Paris. He actually wrote Moonlight in preparation to writing If Beale Street Could Talk, which is what he was working on. And in that time, he was just listening to, like, a lot of Frank Ocean. He saw this screenplay by this gentleman. It was actually a play by Terrell Alvin McQuarrie. And he just saw that screenplay, and he's like, you know what? That was, like, the other thing he wrote while he was in Paris and reading a lot of... He read If Beale Street Could Talk while he was out there, and that made him think about Moonlight, and then he did Moonlight. So he's not been in the game as long.
Yeah, and he's, I mean, in that case, as far as problematicness goes, he has a little bit of an advantage, I guess, because, you know, he's just in more modern times. I don't know. I feel like
Yeah,
that
like he's been
he's had
able
less time
to.
to fuck up.
He's been able to live in a world where he could have digested Spike Lee's work and art and felt it differently, you know, instead of being the person to make those things, he got to live in them and be in that space and watch all of the Spike Lee movies and then create his own art, you know? But
Yeah.
that's different, you know, that affects everything. So that's why I'm like, I'm still gotta give Spike Lee his props for what he did, because he still came before Barry Jenkins did, so.
Yeah, Spike Lee's interesting. But yeah, so today we're gonna be talking about a Netflix original show by Spike Lee called She's Gotta Have It that I literally started watching yesterday.
Oh,
and
I can't wait to hear what you gotta say.
yeah.
I'm excited because
And what are
damn.
you talking about?
Oh, I'm gonna be talking about Moonlight finally by Barry Jenkins.
Finally.
And it's been something I maybe have been trying to put off for a while, just because it's oof,
I've put
it's
it
a
off
lot.
too. I haven't finished watching it.
Wait,
Still.
what?
I
Like
haven't
ever?
finished watching it. No,
Oh,
ever.
dude. I mean, you owe it to yourself because it's beautiful, but I get it. I really do. I understand. It's.
I've started it a couple times and then I'm just kind of like, you know what? I don't think I want to be depressed right now.
Yeah, it's something. And it's, I mean, it's beautiful, but it's a lot. So I get it,
Yeah.
because his directional style is just, it's beautiful, and you feel everything, and so that's a lot.
For sure.
But yeah, I'm excited. Ooh, I really am excited about what you're gonna say about this show, because damn, I got some feelings and some words. But yeah,
Oh, good.
if you want to lead into it,
Oh, do you want me to start?
I do, because I really want to hear this.
I guess I'm just gonna try not to go spoilery because look, the She's Gotta Have It season two just came out. First season came out in 2017, and it's an, like I said, it's a Netflix original by Spike Lee. It's been interesting to watch it because he brings in these his he's done films mostly in his life, and he brings in a lot of like film elements into it that I think are interesting, like when he like repeats a scene when like you know like that's not something that you typically see in TV shows, and I don't know, I think that it's been really interesting to just watch a piece of his work that's in a series form that I know other people have their hands in a lot more because that's how TV is. TV's collaborative, and I think he's had more control over other things. I think in this particular show, he had a lot more control and vision in the first season, and he's used to doing these feature things where like it's an open and shut thing, but it's a TV show. It's open-ended. It has to keep going, and I think it struggled in its second season because he was he's I don't know he, his vision and where it came from, like it's I don't know that it was meant to go past the first season. And I say that because this whole show, She's Gotta Have It, was based on Spike Lee's first ever feature-length film, which had a very low budget and had a way darker twist of events, and he actually played him, the very lovable Mars himself, in that version. Yeah, I think it's pretty safe to say that like the shit that happens in that first movie was pretty fucking problematic.
Yeah.
Actually, I'll get into th I can
Yeah.
get into that. So like the basic premise is pretty much the same. There's Nola Darling. She in the show she's played by DaWanda Wise, and she's three seeing three men at the same time, and she's not really apologetic about it. Like she that's what she's doing. She's not like lying about it. So in both the show and the movie, there's Jamie Overstreet. He's like this. Actually, I don't know if he's married in the movie, but he's this married rich guy who really respects her and treats her really well. And he's grown. Like that's the whole thing about him, that he's like a grown ass man, but he's also married. So like, okay. There's also Greer. He's really conceited, but he's really spontaneous and he's successful photographer, model, beautiful guy who dresses very flamboyantly. And there's everybody's favorite, who's Mars. And at first, when I first saw Mars, I was like, who's played by Anthony Ramos, who I love. I was like, there's no way he's one of the lovers. I thought he was just like some neighborhood kid who like would bother her or something.
Right.
But no, like she like apparently was like wild into this like super like, I don't know, he just looks like a like one of those neighborhood kids that you don't take seriously. But he turns out to be a lot more than that. And we see that as the seasons progress. But yeah, Anthony Ramos is fucking amazing. He's from, he was in Hamilton, A Star Is Born, and he's not going anywhere. That dude's going to be wild successful.
Oh, but yeah. He's awesome.
Yeah, in the show, he's just like this super loyal, funny guy. And in season two, they let him sing, which is magical because the man has some vocal cords. But back to Nola. Oh, well, actually, in the movie, it takes a really like dark twist where they kind of try to force Nola to be like this monogamous person, and she tries celibacy because Jamie turns out to be like the worst fucking person and does all kinds of horrible shit to her. So yeah, there's that. Luckily, it doesn't really go that way to where she's reduced to like this weak woman in the show. At least I don't think so. Not yet, anyways. I don't know where they're going with it. Hasn't ended yet. But speaking of Nola, she in the show is a painter. She's pansexual, and she is a polyamorist. The three P's. and she kind of like encapsulates a lot of what like woke Twitter is today. Like, she's a millennial, intersectional feminist. And like, I don't mean that in a bad way. I think she's a badass, even though and she's flawed. Like, I don't know what to say. She's like in her late 20s or something like that. Like, we're all kinds of fucked up. But the reason that I'm talking about this show today is because of Opal, who's the only woman that she really shows any like actual interest in. I don't know, there's a lot of guys in and out of her life in this show, but Opal is like the main woman.
She's constant in season one.
Yeah, she's pretty amazing. There's a lot of parts of their relationship that I don't like. I don't like the way that they approached their storyline. I think there was issues in it. For one, like the first time that we see Opal or even hear about her is when Nola decides that she wants to go on a break from Dick. Like, I think that was literally like what she says. Yep. She's like, oh, there's no penis in my loving bed. And then she's like, oh, I guess I'll just find a woman. And that, like, you know, that can be just problematic in general to say, because it's like what, she only wants it when, because men aren't around. Like, I don't know. I didn't like that. I didn't like that that was the first time that we saw her. And then like things go badly and go south really, really, really fast, which kind of sucks. And then there's like a long ass break where she doesn't really, there were, nothing's really happening. She's back on her bullshit. And then a really weird ass like Thanksgiving thing happens, and she apparently falls back into a relationship with her that we don't get to see for 18 months. Like, we're supposed to like sit here and be like, oh, this amazing woman gets into a relationship with this other woman, but we don't get to see it for 18 months?
Fuck no, why would we?
Yeah, so this wild ass time lapse doesn't make sense happens when we get to season two. So sorry for the spoiler alert. I think you'll be good, but yeah, I have a lot of mixed feelings. I'm gonna go back to the first season, and that's because the first season was just kind of made a lot more sense to me. Even though I think it was problematic, it's like, the second season was super scatterbrained. They tried to do like these themed episodes, like issue episodes. I don't really mind those, and I enjoyed a lot of them, but the overall season isn't feeling very coherent. I feel like I lost Nola in the chaos, and I just feel like they just thought of episodes and then put them in an order. That's it. There's not really an overarching plot, and so that's why the first season is easier to talk about, because I feel like there's actual progress and plot, even though I don't love a whole lot of it. I think a lot of it is calling out its own bullshit. Like, she's literally just like, she does a thing and these three men react in their own ways that are basically all the same way, but you know, it's just dumb.
Yeah, it is.
Their own way that is the same way.
It's the same shit.
Yeah. And then, I don't know. And then, like, Opal is, like, amazing. But then in the second season, she treats her like a
She's.
child and then gets mad at her for being like a child. I don't. Like, don't treat somebody like a child if you don't want them to act like a child. I don't know.
It just didn't
But
make sense.
it
Like, I,
didn't.
like
Like,
how
how do
they
you go
developed
18
Opal?
months?
Come on. And to not
Like,
show us that, like.
18 months of it, and then, like, apparently they didn't address all these issues in the previous 18 months. I don't know. It was terrible. But yeah, back to the first season, and to bring up a few other characters. I kind of have, they have like this whole storyline with one of the side characters where I'm kind of confused about what they're saying about body image, because this woman is upset 'cause she doesn't have a big butt, and she gets these butt injections, and at first I'm like okay with the storyline because they're kind of like showing how different women have different viewpoints on altering your body, and I generally have the viewpoint of like you should be able to do whatever you want
Yep,
with
it's your
your own
body.
body because it's yours.
Facts.
But they really demonize it, and I think they could have gone about it a good in a better way because yes, there are some really like people women are pressured into seeing their body negatively, and it sucks a lot, and it happens a lot, and they change their bodies to please other people when they should be doing it for themselves. And that's something that they could have talked about, but they didn't. They just kind of went straight for the, oh, if you don't accept your own body, then you're gonna like almost die kind of thing. I
That's
don't know.
bullshit.
Yeah, and it's like you could have done a way better job at talking about how there's like, that how people are taken advantage of because they don't have enough money to go to like these expensive ass plastic surgeons, so they go to these like little like shady spots and then end up really sick because of like bad injections and stuff. Like that's a it's a real issue, but like to make it seem like just because you want to change your body, it's like the worst things are gonna happen to you. It's kind of fucked.
I think like the problem with me in the show is that they suppose themselves to be like woke, but I feel like they're just trying to make fun of woke people, and it's because it feels so like archaic. You know, like you're saying like, "Oh, we're woke, we believe in polyamory," but at the same time it's like we don't believe that you should change your body. And it's like actually in reality, the way that woke millennials work, supposedly us, is that we don't give a fuck. Do whatever you want. It's your body. Just be safe, you know? If you have enough money to go to the DR to get it done, go to the DR to get it done. We mind our business out here. But, and that's what I don't like about this show. Also, the way they treated Opal in season one, because again, I agree with you, season two was a whole different thing. Season one, the way they treated Opal was just as this, like, backup character to when she didn't want dick, like you said. So I was like super pissed. I literally couldn't even bring myself to finish it after the way I saw they treated Opal, and I saw supposedly Nola Darlin treating Opal, and I was just like, this something feels false in this. Something doesn't feel correct. So I just had to stop watching it because it made me so upset because that just didn't register with me. I was like, that's not how women deal with each other. But go off. Like I can tell that there were a lot of men in this room making this decision, and it made me pissed.
I just felt like there was a disconnection too from season one and season two with how Opal was, because Opal was always like, I think her as a character was wonderful in season one, and then
Yep.
season two she was like, I
Bossy
don't know,
and like
yeah, like a mom. Like
mom.
she was just a mom. She was reduced to being that kind of a person. So
And that's
I don't
and
know. I
then
think she
like
was more grown than that. Like I think she would have been better about it.
yeah, and to have like and you know, usually it's not a problem when there's nuance, right? When there's like a bunch of queer women characters and they're all different, but there was only one and she was like that, and that's what made me upset because I was just like, okay, you can't have the one queer woman in your show that she's dating and then show her like that. You know, it's like we don't even get anything. We get morsels of things, right? So this is our morsel and it's bitter? Like, no, thank you. Like, I'm good on that. Like, no, thanks.
It was tough. And at first I was like, I saw some interesting things, like when, because they have gratuitous sex scenes, like it happens a lot, you have to turn down the
Yep.
volume a lot, And
don't watch this with your family, folks.
Yeah, it's wild and out here. And one of the things that I noticed is that, like, they were more, like, when it came to, like, her and Opal's scenes, they were more
they really ready. Showed them.
Yeah, they readily showed their bodies, I guess. And when she was with the guys, it was just, like, up against a freaking bed rest or whatever. I don't know, like, doing some wild-ass positions. I don't know. But, so I thought, I was like, okay, that's doing something interesting here. But they kind of, I don't know, they freaking flailed. I think it was just, like, an excuse, like, to make time pass. It was just, it was kind of annoying. But there are other things that, like, I noticed in the first season that were kind of wild in. Which is Ooh, that, like...
Like what?
Because, okay, in the second season, they have this, like, whole thing where it's, like, grieving about... I think this might be in the first season. I watched it all together, but they have a whole episode where people are, like, pissed off about Donald Trump being president. And then they have another episode that's all about hurricane relief in Puerto Rico. But in, like, episode 6 of the first season... They have this, like, really awkward scene where Nola's in, like, a taxi cab, and you don't even see the taxi cab driver. You don't even see him. Like, he doesn't even get a face. But while she's on the phone, there's, like, somebody with an Indian accent, like a shitty Indian accent, not even a good one. And they do this, like, don't deport me joke that it was...
Oh, fuck that.
Yeah, that was really, like... shitty. Like, they made, I don't know, it was like, it was just really shitty. And I was like, seriously, dude, like, in this day and age, in this show that when it's claiming to be, I don't know. But there's also other things that I feel like they could have hammered down more on. Like, they have an episode where it's all about she starts teaching these underprivileged kids, and then they kind of try to compare it to Virgil, who is this Jamie's son, who goes to this private school, and he's super rich, and he pulls, like, this little Drake thing where he lets his white friends do blackface and he does whiteface thing. Like, so they try to make that comparison, and I'm like, you're trying to do something really awesome here, but they just kind of let it go after a while. I think they could have hammered in a little more there, but I don't know. It was just kind of weird. Like, one little conversation with his dad made the whole thing go away. So, whatever. And then another thing that I thought was interesting was Nola has this, like, art show where I guess she kind of goes through a lot of things all in one night. And then some white, like, art critic guy basically critiques her on her blackness. And then she goes out into this, like, depressive spell, which I thought was actually kind of good for once. Like, yeah, like, that shit happens sometimes. Like, white people having the power to, like, ruin your whole ass mood for a while, and then you have to, like, retrace the steps of what's going on here and, like, how white supremacy works and stuff. So that was almost kind of interesting, but once again, kind of got let go. So, I don't know. And probably one of the last things I want to talk about is Papo, who is this homeless artist and Afro-Latino greatness. He's a veteran, and they call him the mayor of Fort Greene, who was amazing in season one. I love him in season one. He was pretty much non-existent in season two. Once again, season two is just, like, losing me. But he's the best. He's always, like, this Dominican guy. He's, like, wild, proud of being Dominican, and he has this art... And he walks around and he's, like, blasting, like, music in Spanish, and he's speaking Spanish to everybody, and he's trying to hustle and, like, make money, and he's always, like, super kind to Nola. So I think that's, like, the most that I've seen a homeless person humanized on television in that first season only, where they, like, really try to do something there. And then they have this whole scene where the police get called on him. That you know, like, when this actually, I will give them credit there, like, in the second season they do follow up on, but yeah, where he ends up getting arrested for no reason. Yep. Like, it's just because some white woman says he did something that he definitely didn't do. I don't know why anybody would believe that this guy who's homeless would waste the few dollars that he has on a spray paint can so that he could deface some woman's property. Like, why would he waste his money on that if he has some, you know? So I just think that it was pretty ridiculous. But so that was, I will say that his whole character in season one was great. Love Bappo, who changes his name later to Divine,
Oh yeah, after he
which is
was in,
interesting. Yeah,
after
after
he was
spending
locked up.
like that whole 18-month break in prison, which is wild, but also kind of realistic.
Yeah, he came out like a different person, and I like that he picked a different name for himself, 'cause that's pretty cool too, like to choose yourself, to choose
Yeah,
something else. That's, I think that's
like
cool.
they give him the smallest moment.
Yeah, it was like early on too. So,
Yeah,
but
I feel like they just kind of closed off a lot of like these Brooklynites, like who were, I don't know, felt really like real and homey, and then they like went off on like a retreat in season two. I don't know what the fuck happened.
retreat.
The last thing I'll say about She's Gotta Have It is in season two, there's an episode where she gets chosen to go on this retreat for black artists that turns out to be mad problematic, like the funding behind it. But she does have like this really interesting conversation with this African artist. Well, actually, I guess he's more like he's just British. He's like a British artist who like is more tied to his African roots, whereas and he like really differentiates himself from African Americans and how they he feels like he doesn't have the weight of like racism and slavery on his shoulders like African Americans do because like they're here, and she like challenges that in him, and they have just like the most interesting conversation that I think is definitely worth watching, because like Nola for 1 second is just like so sick of white people that she's just like, we should have never integrated with them, like we should have just stayed separate, which is, I don't know, I think it was a very interesting thing to bring up in this show. But once again, I haven't seen them really follow up on that whole storyline. I also haven't completely finished season two, but it's a mess right now from what I'm seeing.
Dude, I
It's
had to stop
wild though.
watching season two. What did you, what were you rated? Like,
Season one, I would probably say just like one cafecito for these little, maybe 1.5 cafecitos for these little bits and pieces where it's problematic and doesn't make sense. And for the way that they approach the Nola and Opal thing, even though I think that they have a very like I like the way that Opal is shown in the first season a lot more.
she's cool.
The second season just God like lost me, man. Like fucking two cafecitos probably. Like I don't know. I'm still watching it. I'll probably finish it too. I just think that I still think it's worth watching for most people. Because it's an example of like a lot of things done very interestingly, like as a just like the style of filmmaking, I guess, I think is very interesting, and characters like Bapo are really interesting, and even Nola I think is a very interesting character. But I also think it's a great example of a lot of things that are done wrong under bad direction. So overall, I think it's like a great study piece. I don't know. It reminds me of like film school when we would study things because that were older. But even by Spike Lee, I studied Do the Right Thing, and it was just like a lot of things done really well and a lot of things done really shitty.
Yeah, dude. I couldn't finish season two of She's Gotta Have It. I mean, I only watched it for Opal, and then what they did to Opal, I was like, bye, I'm done. I'm good. I don't need the rest of this shit. It was good
Yeah.
while it lasted, when it sucked at the very end, so thanks so much for nothing. I was real mad. I was fucking mad. I was like, fuck
Yeah.
this. This ain't for me, man. Like, we are, nah. We're already just like a trope to him. 'Cause we were talking about how he's interpreted queer women on film before on his other movie, She Hate Me. So I really wanted to give him a try to see if maybe he had come far away from She Hate Me, and I don't think he has. Honestly, I don't think he's obviously not as terrible as She Hate Me, but this shit isn't gonna make up for it. It's not better in that sense. I just can't. I can't. The way he treats queer women, queer black women, is it's not for me, you know. I can't do it.
Yeah, it's not all there. I mean, what are you gonna, I mean, I don't know. I guess I don't have that expectation for him either. Like, I don't think of Spike Lee and think, oh yeah, he'll definitely do this justice. Like, no, it's not what I,
oh,
like,
I mean,
his strong suits are elsewhere.
Yeah, and I don't think of Spike Lee in the way that everyone else does. I think he's a masterful director and he makes things interestingly, like you said, but he's not for me. Like, I don't, like, he's made some shit that I really like, but at the same time, he's made some shit that I fucking abhor with my whole fucking heart. And I think he's like, his politics are like 14-year-old woke boy who just got woke and doesn't know the whole story. Like, you know, Black Klansman, like, siding with the police. Like, I'm not into that. So I was just like, you're not really doing good on with Cynthia's track record. So I don't fuck with Spike Lee that much. He's cool or whatever, but he's not for me. I'm not going to disregard his art, but just, he's not for me.
Yeah, no, I get it. Yeah. But let's talk about Moonlight.
Oh my God. Moving on to something beautiful and, oh God, just levels and levels and levels of like trauma and just beautiful artistry. Moonlight came out, if you don't know, Moonlight won an Oscar. It came out in 2016. It's directed by Barry Jenkins. It was written, the screenplay and the play was written by Terrell Alvin McCurry. It stars Mahershala Ali, Naomi Harris, Trevante Rhodes. You would know him because he's super fine. Ashton Sanders plays kind of like high school version of Chiron. Alex Hibbert plays Chiron when he's very young in elementary school. And it's probably one of the most beautiful films of 2016. I really thought Barry Jenkins was doing a super cool thing by separating the story into three chapters, each named after the character and his chosen name in those periods of his life. It's about a young man called Chiron growing up in Liberty City, Miami. It's the hood. And he placed it in the time, I think a little bit different from the actual play. I think the play was right in the middle of like the early 80s, and this one was more like late 80s. That does matter because you're progressing the story as this life progresses, and the way like Boyhood kind of films the same character go through all these years. Kind of similar, different actors. Chapter one is called Little, and I think that's maybe one of the most significant parts of the entire movie is when Chiron is a child and you're introduced to his life immediately. The first character on screen that you see is actually Mahershala Ali. He's wearing his do-rag. He's riding around his whip in Liberty City. He meets up with like a corner boy selling probably crack, selling drugs. And you kind of get introduced to him and his life. And he's really central to the story because as you go on, you realize that Chiron's only real knowledge of like love and sensitivity and his understanding of Black masculinity in a healthy way all comes from the same man who is a drug dealer in his community. And instead, one of the best things I like about Barry Jenkins and this writer, Terrell Alvin McCurry, is that what you're seeing is stereotypes and tropes that don't exist in this fucking movie for Black men. What we're used to seeing in film, in Black American film, is these stereotypes, these ideas of what Black men were told to be by white people. And what you're seeing in this movie is what Black men choose to be, what Black men are, and how maybe white people have never seen Black people be humanized before. So one of my favorite things about this movie, and one of the things that upset me about white people when they watch this movie, is that they always seem to kind of not understand Mahershala Ali's character. He is the drug dealer in this movie. He is also the father figure in this movie. He's also a man showing deep sensitivity, love, and caring for a young boy. And I think they cannot see that Black men can contain multitudes like that, that he can both be a drug dealer and also an extremely loving, caring, almost stepfather figure to this young man. And most white people, when they saw this movie, and I want to make sure that's very clear, and it pissed me off when it came out in 2016, and that's why I wasn't ready to talk about it, is because it made me so upset, is that white people kept questioning. They're like, but how can this drug dealer be all of these things? And it pisses me off to this day because that is how they interpret black men who sell drugs or black men who wear do-rags, is that they can't be both loving and caring and have a family and both be humanized. And this movie humanizes black people to white people. It didn't do that for me. I already fucking know that. We're humans, duh. But that's what pissed me off when I first saw this movie, was just hearing white people talk about Mahershala Ali's character. And he did win an Oscar, I believe, for it, right? I'm not crazy. For his role in this movie. And the whole idea of black masculinity in America has been, you know, you have to be this hood dude. You have to be this tough guy. Most movies, when they find a young man, they usually take him under his wing and they create him to become the mini version of himself. And instead, what you find is Mahershala Ali finds Chiron's character scared, afraid, and he nurtures him. He teaches him how to swim. He shows him kindness where he's not getting at home. Chiron's mother is addicted to drugs. And as you see the movie progress, there's one super heartbreaking scene where Mahershala Ali realizes that he's been selling drugs to Chiron's mother. And that's where you see this fucking small all-black universe come all together. Their whole lives come together right there. And then the very next scene that's also super fucking heartbreaking is Chiron having a conversation with Mahershala Ali. And it's a really delicate conversation because Chiron is trying to figure out his identity. And Mahershala Ali's character, Juan, he's Afro-Latino, he's Cuban, is explaining to Chiron, you know, like, you can always choose who you're going to be. You can choose what you are. You can choose who you're going to be. But in a lot of ways, Chiron's life doesn't feel like a choice. It all feels like destiny. Like, things are happening to him that are very much outside of his control. And there's this really crazy conversation, this really emotional conversation that Chiron has with him at a dinner table. It's very gentle. Chiron is asking, you know, why do they call me the F word? And what does it mean? Am I that? And what you're finding is that Mahershala Ali's character explains to him very, very kindly, very gently, like, you know, it's a word that people use to make gay people feel bad. And he's like, well, how do I know I'm one? And he just tells him, you know, it's just something you're going to figure out for yourself, and it's okay. And right there in that gentleness, I think it centers and it kind of creates something with the characters and who they become later on in life. And Chiron's destiny from there, I think you see it from there. It's just, oh my God, this movie. The second part of this movie is him in his teenage years. And it's really like, you know, trigger warning. If you have a lot of like trauma from being queer, or if you can't see queer people being beaten up, then don't watch the second part. But I think the second part is extremely interesting because you see Chiron interacting with his childhood friend, Kevin, and you see their intimacy. You know, you see them be themselves together, whereas Kevin is kind of like the polar opposite of Chiron's character. Kevin is always out here being what other people want him to be. You know, he's probably selling drugs, he's smoking weed, he's out here fucking girls because he probably thinks that's what other people expect of him, and he's living up to that. Whereas Chiron's character is literally just fighting to survive, to be himself. Whatever he is, he's not completely sure of it, but he's not exactly trying to be what other people want him to be. He's wearing like skinny jeans and he doesn't look like everyone else in his environment. He stands out because he is different and he gets picked on for it. But what you find is that Kevin and him together, when they're alone, there's something that's similar. They find the similarities and they are able to connect with each other. And I think Chiron is finally able to connect with another man other than Mahershala Ali's character. And he's able to connect fully and romantically. And there's a scene on the beach that is so fucking tender. And you never get to see black men be that tender in film and be taken that seriously in Hollywood. You know, it wasn't gratuitous. It wasn't, you know, over the top. It was, in fact, you don't even see anything. And I think maybe that made it more real, the tenderness of what was happening in that moment between those two men on that beach. It just, I don't know, dude, like it was really beautiful and it was shot really well. And it just, you hear the waves splashing while they're being intimate, like it did in the very beginning of the movie. It's how it opens up. It's just waves crashing. And that's how the movie ends as well, with waves crashing. And by the end of the film, Chiron's character is completely turned into like a different version of Mahershala Ali's character, of Juan. He becomes, Juan's nickname throughout the movie is Blue, and his nickname that was given to him by Kevin, Chiron, becomes Black. And he grows up to be exactly the same person, almost, as Mahershala Ali, except he hasn't been able to be intimate. He hasn't been able to have real human connections because of his relationship, his fragmented relationship with his drug-addicted mother, Juan dying, you know? Everyone in spoilers. His life. Oh, yeah, my bad. It's 2016. It's
wild spoilers.
You haven't seen this. I'm so sorry. No. And he becomes a different version of the only man that's ever shown him love and tenderness. And it's heartbreaking because you can see that he's completely walled himself away from the world. And whoever he was when he was little, it's still in there, but he's armored that person. You know, he's put that person way, way, way back in there. And when he finally meets up with Kevin again in this part three of the story, because they're the three recurring parts of the story, he's in there. He sees him again, and he becomes the same Chiron he was when he was a child, or same Chiron he was when he was on that beach with him. So it's beautifully shot. It's beautifully told. We never get to see Black men being... Well, we do, but we don't get to see them not be violent. We get to see drug dealers be humanized, and I think that's women who are addicted to drugs be humanized. And I think it's rare, and I think it's not happened since in the same way that queer Black men were allowed to exist in a space where they are shown so much fucking respect other than pose. And so I really love this movie, and I wasn't ready to talk about it for a very long time because it makes me mad the way that white people see this movie, because we heard a lot of what white people were saying when this movie came out, and fuck that. I didn't want to hear white people's opinion on this movie, frankly. I still don't. And it still makes me upset that when I Google Moonlight, I still see a bunch of white people's names on these fucking, these white dudes telling me how to feel about Moonlight. Fuck you, Roger and Ebert. Like, no. So
I mean, he's dead, but yeah, I feel that.
You know, the website still exists. There's still white dudes writing for him. So it's just so much more and so beautiful. And the cinematography is insane. What they're asking for from Ashton Sanders, who plays Chiron in the middle of his life as a teenager, he's doing a lot of motherfucking labor there. And it's everything so fucking subtle and so beautiful. And shout out to Janelle Monáe, who had a very small character as Teresa, as a Marshall Ali's girlfriend.
As far as I've gotten in this movie, Janelle Monáe's been like the most interesting thing so far. I haven't gotten far.
She very doesn't far get a lot of scenes, but
every I guess scene I've that seen most in, of them.
She's amazing in this movie. She's a very strong, like, strong mother figure for Chiron that he doesn't get to have, and she's kind of like the most normalizing character in the movie, but. Other than Juan's character, but Juan, you know, he's a drug dealer. So
you don't get to hear a whole lot about Janelle Monáe's part in this. She's also in that very emotional scene where he asks about the F word.
Yes, and she turns to Juan and goes, you know, no, don't say something else. She looks at him like, no.
Stop there.
Stop.
She's great. I love her.
It's everything is very subtle in this movie, and it's beautiful. I mean, what parts have you made it halfway? I'm sorry for the spoilers.
Yeah, I made it like 42 minutes in. I have it up on my screen right now.
Okay, you should finish watching it just because the ending it's heartbreaking. You're gonna need a hug afterwards, maybe. Let me know how you feel after you finish watching it, but. Dude, I just got tired of hearing white people talk about it. Like, I think other than us, like, I really like Latinos Who Lunch, their take on Moonlight when they covered it. That was pretty beautiful. So.
Word. Yeah, I haven't watched it. I really want to, and I've always, I don't know. It's never been the right time.
I mean, there's never going to be a right time to have your heart broken in like that, you know? Like, it's never a right time, right? But I think it's completely necessary, and... I think everyone should watch it just because it's beautiful. And it's there's just so much that, you know, he works in subtleties. He works in the silences, you know. Everything's everything's coded, you know, everything is about the scene itself and you have to pay attention. And I love it. I love open-endedness. I love the silences. I love quietness. So this is right on my alley. I'll fuck with it. It's so good.
Word. Yeah, I'm going to finish it after this. I was watching it while I was doing my She's Gotta Have It notes.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
You should do it. I've seen it like three, like, you know, dude, I'm not going to lie. Before this, I'd only watched it one time in theaters. And then, like, I just completely cried after that. And, like, I bawled after this movie. And then I just didn't want to watch it again for the same reason that, like, I kept trying to. And I kept going, nah, I'm not doing that to myself today. And then going back to it, it's so heartbreaking, dude. Like, it's just to imagine that. To be in that space in my head, I can't do that all the time with Moonlight. But it's necessary. And I give it 5 pan dulces. I really fuck with Moonlight. And I reckon everybody watch it maybe once a year just to remind yourself of humanity. I don't know. I think white people should watch it every other day so they can just be like, oh, wow, drug dealers have
feelings. Mandatory reading.
Mandatory reading for white people if you just want to be a good human being. Watch Moonlight so you can be less shitty of a human. But yeah.
Word.
And there's no gratuitous sex scenes, so you can watch it with family.
The one thing I will say about both of these things, which is She's Gotta Have It and Moonlight, is that they have I don't think Marshall Ali is actually Afro Latino, but they both have Afro Latino representation, which is, you know, at least fictionally, which is really cool for me. Like, that's really great. Like, I thought that, I think it's, you know, people talk about needing more Afro Latino representation all the time, and I'm like, yo, there was actually like wild representation for them in She's Gotta Have It. Like, there was multiple characters who are very different from each other who are Afro-Latinos in Brooklyn. And I'm so glad that they didn't get erased. Glad.
Yeah, Moonlight, like, Gerald Jerome, I think he is Afro-Latino in the character, too. I don't know if in the character, too, but I think in real life he is, like, Afro-Latino. And Juan in Moonlight brings up the fact that he's like, you know, there's black people everywhere. Don't let anyone tell you that there are black people aren't on a continent. He's like, there's this whole conversation about ethnicity is beautiful, about being, like, Afro-Latino and, like, oh, the name of the movie is actually comes from the name of the play, which is, I didn't mention this. I thought that was beautiful, too. It was like, in Moonlight, black boys look blue. And I thought that was cool as fuck. There's a lot with the moon and the water and its symbolism with Chiron. It's beautiful.
Yeah. It's good so far. I haven't finished it, but yeah, the blue hues have been catching my attention, at least.
Oh yeah, and then the cinematography. The cinematography is lit.
Mm-hmm. It's lit by blues. Yeah,
it is. It's beautiful.
But yeah, do you have anything that you want to say before we start closing out the episode? Like, any new announcements? Anything you want to say?
No, but this comes out the same day that I'll be at Pride Night at the Dallas Wings WNBA game. I'm hyped for it. It's my first, like, WNBA game / Pride event, and I expect one lesbian couple to get engaged that night, I hope. It just,
you
that
never
would
know.
Yay, shout out to love. But shout yeah out. So that's about it I can think right now. Happy Pride, y'all. Keep being gay forever. Yeah, I can't think of anything else.
For sure. All right, cool. Well, I hope that you guys enjoyed this episode and that you watch these things if you haven't already or enjoyed what we had to say about it. Follow us at CYC Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, and facebook.com/CYC Pod, patreon.com/CYC Podcast if you want to support us. My personal is MYTE Panda.
Mine is at Fried Papita.
And that's it.
Does it. Bye.